It is wonderful to see you all. Roz, it's good to see
sir.
You. You made
in
it.
In the dark.
but I know that's Roz. Uh-huh. I got it. It's wonderful. Wonderful to see you all. And I see the princes. Nice. And the Becker Kornblatt. Sharon, good to see you. Susan, Alan and Sandy, beautiful. Love the chair. Love the furniture. Yeah. Looks beautiful.
Good job, Alan, Sandy.
Yeah, no, I'm sure they're getting ready. Okay, but a few people had asked me over the week, so what's the next room? You know, because we're going through room by room to tour the Jewish home. And I told them we're not going into any rooms. And they said, are we having a special subject? I said, no. So, well, I don't understand. Oh, we're still in the garden, right? I said, no, we decided last week that we're not going to be in the garden. So again, like, where are we then? So picture your wall. There we go. Okay, I'm back.
All right, here he is.
Lost you there. Sorry.
Yep.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep. Okay, fine. So let me just conclude the whole class. The point is that we were coming up. I parked my car and I started walking towards your house. And last week we came across the garden. And we talked about the mitzvah of Arla, right? That was pertaining to the garden. But I keep going and I'm coming up your steps and I come onto your porch. Because most of us have a porch before we get to the front door. Well, I'm going to throw it back to you and say, hey, what mitzvah is associated with being on the porch? What would you say?
Welcoming guests.
Okay, you could be welcoming guests, although most of us don't welcome the guests on the porch.
The mezuzah on the door.
Mezuzah on the door we're going to get to, but we're not even up to the front door. I'm literally on the porch.
Well, you'd be on my ramp.
Okay.
I don't know.
Dumped you all already? Okay, so let me tell you a story. Story was that about 6 years ago, my wife and I decided that because off of the back of our house, there was off of the kitchen, there was a very small concrete, I'll call it a porch, more of a landing of some sort, that had a stone circular staircase going down to the backyard. The house is built into a hill. So the front of the house, you only go up 3 or 4 steps. But if you're going out the back of the house, it's a ranch. Go out the back, you have an entire flight of stairs that you'd have to go down. Unfortunately, the concrete was cracking and the posts that were holding up that little concrete slab were beginning to rot, rust. And it really was a danger. So made the decision that we were going to take it down and we were going to rebuild and put on a porch, a screened-in porch, and a deck. Why am I telling you this story? Is because I remembered that there's a special mitzvah in the Torah. The mitzvah in the Torah is that when you have a flat roof, let's say, or an area that is raised from the ground, and it's a part where people might go, you're obligated to put up a fence. You're obligated to put up what we would call a railing.
Mm.
Something that will protect people from falling off of that porch, falling off of that deck, falling off of that area, that flat roof, if people go there. Here's what's interesting. I had remembered that is a mitzvah in the Torah, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. But I was curious. It's not something that it's a mitzvah that many people get to do in their lifetime. If you buy a home and it already has it, you don't have to do it. So I went to my rabbi, and I had studied a little bit about the laws, and I knew that the requirement was that it had to be a minimum, the railing, the gate, the fence, whatever you want to call it, the guardrail, had to be, in Hebrew we say, 10 tefachim, 10 handbreadths That's what they're translated in English. 10 hand breaths, approximately from the bottom of this to the top of this, is considered one. This is a tefach. I'm approximating. So 10 tefachim high. So I said, great. I can build it on biblical terms if I know what a tefach is in inches. I said, Rabbi, help me out here. There's a difference of opinion as to how many inches constitutes a tefach. How many would 10 tefachim be? So we had a discussion about it, and he told me that if you want to cover all opinions and have it done right, then do it 39 to 40 inches off the floor of the porch. Okay? Regardless of how high up off the ground, it doesn't matter. It's from the floor of the porch. You need a railing that goes up approximately 39 to 40. Fine. I said, I want to do it the right way. I go to the contractor and I say to him, how high are you building the railing? He gets very defensive and he says, well, the Baltimore City building code requires it to be 36 inches. I said, that's great. Can you make it 40? Why? I don't understand. I've been doing decks and porches my whole life. Why? Baltimore City says 36 inches. I said, Steve, have I driven you crazy about any of the other requirements about how I want this and I want that? And have I driven you crazy? He thinks for a moment. He goes, no, not really. I said, good. Then consider this my one meshuga request. This is my one crazy request. You don't understand it? I'm not asking you to understand it. I, as the homeowner who's going to write the check for you to do this porch, I want the top of the railing to be 40 inches from the floor. I can't do it. I said, what do you mean you can't do it? He says, no, because the way this railing works is you have the spindle. That's the, you know, the rod that goes from the bottom of the thing to the top. It only fits. If I'm going to lift up the top railing another 3 to 4 inches, the spindle is going to fall out. It won't hold it. I said, wow, Steve, that's an excellent, excellent question. You figure it out. You're the contractor. I want the top of the railing at 40 inches. I want to do this mitzvah. Comes back to me and he says, okay, I figured it out. Which he did. He figured out that the bottom railing, the bottom of the railing is hollow. And that's how they do it. So he figured out that if he puts in a piece of wood inside the bottom railing, right? Picture this is the space in between, and you put a piece of wood and it goes up till here. The spindle sits on the piece of wood and it's been raised a couple of inches now. So that's what we did. And my railing sits from floor to the top of the railing is 40 inches. This is the story. He thought I was nuts. And interestingly enough, when they were doing the screened-in porch, which is right next to the deck, the worker who had heard the whole conversation said to me, you know, we're required to put up it's a knee something. They required to put up a little piece of something, again, so you don't go flying through the screen. And again, Baltimore City requirement was that it'd be 36 inches. So he heard the whole conversation. He said, you wanted it 40? I said, exactly. I want the top at the 40. And that's what we have. So all around my deck, all around my screened-in porch, the top railing is 40 inches from the floor. Okay. This is the mitzvah. The mitzvah is called Ma'akeh, M-A-A-K-E-H, Ma'akeh. And I'll read you the verse. I'll read you straight from the Torah. It's from Devarim, Deuteronomy, chapter 22, verse number 8. If you build a new house, you shall make a fence for your roof so that you will not place blood in your house if a fallen one falls from it. Simple, one sentence. This is not a paragraph. This is not in 13 different places, you know, throughout the Torah. One sentence. Building a house, you're required to put up a fence around the roof. Simple. You say, Rabbi, how are you going to get 45 minutes to an hour out of this material? Excellent question. So let's start with the basics. The basics are, number one, is that we're talking about a physical guardrail, a physical barrier to protect others from falling, or ourselves from falling. If you listen carefully to the verse, and I'll read it again, you hear that the Torah is concerned about somebody falling, and it will be your responsibility. Yes, if the Shlemiel and the Shlemazel are visiting you and they fall off, because the Shlemiel pushed the Shlemazel, and he falls off of your roof, falls off of your porch, your deck, and you didn't have a railing, you, the homeowner, are responsible. I'll read it to you again. You shall, if you build a new house. I get too excited and the whole system goes down. Mm-hmm. I don't get it. Sorry. If you build a new house, you shall make a fence for your roof so that you will not place blood in your house if a fallen one falls from it. If a person gets hurt, meaning the person can die, blood is spilled or is injured, you are responsible. Now, you say to me, but why is it my problem that he or she is a Shlemazel? Why is that my problem? Yeah, the Torah makes it very, very clear. You have to take precautions, even if the person is being foolish or the person is being whatever. I'll tell you others in more about this in a second. But notice that the Torah is very concerned about making sure that nobody gets hurt. In fact, let's go back. Let's read the verse right next to it. The verse immediately before it. Sorry, the verse right after it. Or it's even actually the same one. Right? That there not be any blood in your, because of you. Our sages teach us in the Talmud a beautiful thing. This is not limited to the guardrail around your porch. You know what this is? Any object or any condition of potential danger. You have to fix the broken step leading up to your porch because somebody might hurt themselves. They might fall and crack their skull open or break a leg, twist an ankle. If you have loose wires, if you have, you know, as parents, we're always so careful, thank God, and we put all of the cleaning supplies when your children were younger, you put it behind a locked cabinet. Not just because it's smart, but the Torah demands that we take precautions that any dangerous, potentially dangerous situation, that's on you to take care of. But I think there's a tremendous lesson, even just about the pure physical requirement of putting up a guardrail, teaches us an amazing lesson in Judaism. And that is the preservation of life is a major moral responsibility. It is up to us to protect someone's life. You say, but people, they'll be careful. I mean, everybody knows you don't walk near the edge. Everybody knows that. Yeah. But unfortunately, we are human and we fall prey to the human condition of forgetfulness. Forgetfulness, being distracted. That's just a reality. I'll give you an example. We all know if you have a pool in your backyard. Am I frozen? Have I lost you all again? Hello? Yes. Hello? Am I there?
You're here. Yeah.
In and out.
Dad, you got to figure this out. Sorry. I don't know what is going on. I've been teaching classes down here for quite a while. I don't know what's going on the last few weeks. I'll have to restart my modem. Anyway, if you own a pool.
What does it say about a pool?
Right. Mm-hmm. If you own a pool in your backyard, we have to take precautions. You have to put up a fence and you have to lock it. It's common. But unfortunately, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know. Just read the newspaper. How many times, unfortunately, there are pool accidents of a child wandering in. It happens. Or let's talk about, I love the fact that there's a wonderful campaign now throughout society of being careful about not locking your car without looking for the child in the back seat. No parent, if you were to ask them, would you leave your child in a hot car? They answer, of course, no. Then why does it happen? Because we got distracted. We got a phone call, or I had to make a phone call, or I got a text. Right? These things happen. Not because we're evil people, we're cruel. We are prone to distractions and forgetfulness. So yes, everybody knows you don't walk right on the edge of things, but people do, because that's who we are. I'm not paying attention. The Torah wants us. We're not the Shlemiel. We're not the Shlemazel. I'm a simple homeowner. The Torah wants us to take all necessary precautions to protect the Shlemiel and Shlemazel. That's on us. Unfortunately, you know, again, using common, relevant, contemporary issues, crazy stories about children who get a hold of a loaded gun. Why? Because the person didn't lock it up. I'm not saying yay, nay, I'm pro, I'm a con. It's a fact. If you're going to have a gun in your house, it has to be locked up. There's not a month that goes by that somebody gets hurt with a loaded gun accidentally, because that's who we are. We're human beings and we make those forgetful decisions, or we lose and we're distracted. The very first lesson the Torah is teaching us about this mitzvah of ma'akeh, of putting up a fence, a guardrail on your roof, on your porch, on your deck, is because we value the preservation of life. It is our moral responsibility, and we need to do whatever we can to remove potential dangers. We have a heightened sensitivity to others. It's not only about us. It's about the guests that might come by. The Torah wants us to be sensitive to that. Okay. But I know that you're asking and you want more. But there is more. If you think about it, this concept that we are prone to forgetfulness and distractions is really the basis of many rabbinic enactments. I'll give you an example. Okay? The law is that we know a biblical commandment, a mitzvah in the Torah, to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. We all know that. That's a given, right? We blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. However, the law is that if the Rosh Hashanah day one falls out on Shabbos, in traditional circles, we don't blow the shofar on Shabbos, and we will only blow it on the second day. You say, but Rabbi, the Torah says explicitly, on the first day of the seventh month, you are to blow the shofar. It says it black on white in the Torah. How could somebody come along and say, no, don't do it? The rabbis came along and said, don't do it. The Torah doesn't say it. The Torah seems to imply the opposite, that you are to do it. So this is an important concept. It probably will get me down adrift from where I want to be, but we're all friends. We'll figure it out. The rabbis who come along in a later day, right? The Torah says to blow it on Rosh Hashanah. But the rabbis are concerned. There's a real bona fide issue at stake here. And that is, they were concerned that somebody who's going to want to learn to blow the shofar because his wife is home, or he's homesick and he wants to learn, he's going to take his shofar on Rosh Hashanah, which is on Shabbos, and he's going to walk to the guy who knows how to blow shofar in the afternoon. And he's going to say, here, teach me to blow. I want to learn to blow the shofar. Well, the guy is more than happy to teach it. There's one little problem. He carried the shofar from his house to the shofar blower's house, and he walked through public area. One of the 39 categories of work that we don't do on Shabbos is we don't carry. It could be the smallest little thing, a key in my pocket. See, this is another whole discussion. But one of those 39 categories is we don't carry from a private to a public domain or vice versa. My carrying a shofar from my house to go visit Susan in her house, because I know she's a shofar blower, I'm going to have her teach me. So I can't do that on Shabbos. I can't carry it. Oh my. Okay, I'm changing rooms. Hang in there.
Okay. You going to the porch? No, it's too cold.
No, I am going somewhere else. This is crazy. Sorry. You can get a quick tour of my house.
Closer to your right.
I see.
Yep.
Hello.
Get an extender.
I'm
get
here. Good to see you.
I keep losing the internet. Okay. Hold on. Let me just replug this in. Zippy. Can I trouble you for the extender?
Okay, put me on mute again.
This is the box, the printer box, and the extender.
Got it.
Mine. Yes, please. Sorry, folks. Okay.
Somebody put the Muzak on.
Sorry. Hold on. Hold on.
You know what this is trying to tell us?
Ah, Roz, you're so funny.
Telling us we need to be together again.
Patience.
I already spoke to Rabbi Dave and others. I think for the Hanukkah one, the one in December, I think I'll come up to Frederick and we'll do a special Hanukkah one in person. I'm leaning towards that.
Okay.
I'll let you know about that. Okay. There we go. Perfect. Thank you, Tippy. Okay. Hi. Welcome to the evening, everybody. No, we'll start again. Okay. Well, I don't know where I lost you.
Can I ask a question about the guy blowing shofar?
Yes. I haven't finished that. That's what I'm in the middle of.
But if you blow shofar, does that count as the mitzvah of hearing shofar?
So obviously the blower hears it as well. The mitzvah is listening. The mitzvah is hearing it.
Oh, but you don't have hearing yourself blow still fulfills the mitzvah?
Absolutely.
Oh, I didn't
realize. How else is that person supposed to fulfill the mitzvah?
Listening to somebody else blow.
No requirement. No.
So does saying the Megillah qualify for hearing the Megillah?
Yes. I'm assuming you're able to hear your own words.
Okay, I didn't know if it counted.
Yes.
Well, you could double dip.
Well, yes, because otherwise it makes life a little difficult for the guy who's doing it.
Okay.
But let's just get back to that shofar example for one moment here. The Torah says to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. The rabbis came along and said, no, but if it's on Shabbos, don't do it. How could they override a biblical mitzvah of when the Torah says blow it and some human being comes along and says, no, don't do it if it's Shabbos? The Torah doesn't say that. Zip, can you put on these lights, please? Right? It's a fair question. How do they do that? Interesting, Liz, you say the same thing in terms of the Megillah. It can't fall out anymore. The calendar has been fixed to a point of where Purim can't fall out on Shabbos. But in the old days, it was possible that they would have read it early. But you can't do it on Shabbos. Why? Because the rabbi said, because you might come to carry the Megillah to the shul or to somebody else. You can't carry on Shabbos. Now, let me just stop for a moment. I know the words I'm saying to some of you are like I'm talking Japanese here. The idea of not carrying on Shabbos is one of the 39 categories of quote unquote work. In our day and age, ladies and gentlemen, it's almost impractical. Because in many large Jewish communities, they build something called an Eruv. An Eruv is a construct that allows us to carry. I'm not going to get into the details of how it works, but for all intents and purposes, what it does is it takes all of the homes, all of the buildings, all of this community and makes it one private domain. You're not transferring from one domain to another. That's the basic mechanics. In Baltimore, for example, I can carry my talis. I can carry one of my books. I can carry my house key. I'm allowed to carry things that I need for Shabbos because there is this Eruv. I'm staying within. For example, we all understand that I can carry something from my kitchen to my dining room inside the same house. There's no violation of any Shabbos principle because I'm staying within one area, one domain called my house. But the minute I leave my house, private domain, and I enter out into the public area, a street or a larger area, now I'm transferring that item from private to public or vice versa, public to private. That you can't do on Shabbos. So the rabbis were concerned that a person might bring his shofar to go learn how to blow shofar. Or, let's use Liz's example, he didn't get a chance to hear it. So he's bringing a shofar to the shofar blower. He doesn't realize the shofar blower still has his, for whatever the reason, and he wants to hear the shofar being blown. Because there's a concern, he might do this, he might carry on Shabbos. When he's not allowed to, there's no Eruv. The rabbi said, don't blow shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah if it's on Shabbos. They overrode the biblical law. I ask you, forget the technical part of how do they do that. We can shelve that for another time. But think about what is motivating them. Because one shlemiel might forget it's Shabbos and might want to go learn how to blow shofar. Therefore, the entire Jewish nation doesn't blow the shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah when it falls on Shabbos. Really? Yes, that is exactly the point. We are susceptible to those kinds of forgetfulness and distractions. In that case, it's a distraction of he wants to fulfill the mitzvah. That's a beautiful motivation and it's a beautiful idea, but he forgot a basic premise. You can't do that on Shabbos. He's not purposely saying, I want to carry because he forgot. He's not paying attention. He's being forgetful. There are many such rabbinic laws or enactments to protect from the forgetfulness, inadvertently forgetting. Here's another example. Technically speaking, if I own an animal, I own a horse, it's my horse, not a random horse, not somebody else's, mine, I own it. Technically, from a purely biblical standpoint, I would be allowed to ride that horse on Shabbos. It's my horse. However, don't. Hopefully Zoom won't cut out in the middle of the sentence because then you guys are all going to go start riding your horse. You can't do it. Rabbinically, they made a restriction on that. Why? Because, in the old days, you didn't always have all of your equipment. How did you get the horse to run? You took a stick. And you give it a little swat towards the back. Well, not everybody has what's it called? A crop?
Right, crop.
Look at that. Look at that. Right? Now, they didn't have crops. I mean, that's a new invention, man. Nobody, yeah. What you do is you pass by a tree, whatever it is, and you tore off a branch and you started hitting. That's the way they always did it. But what if he's doing that on Shabbos? Well, one of the 39 categories is you can't start cutting and breaking off branches from a tree on Shabbos. Is he purposely violating it? No, it's inadvertent. It's distracting. He's forgetting. The rabbi said, I don't want him to come into that situation. Here's one more example. And you're all going to look at me like I'm crazy, but whatever. That's fine. Like I said, we're all friends. Am I allowed, answer the question very technically, am I allowed to pick up a pen on Shabbos? Shake your head.
No.
Cannot pick up a pen. Alan's shaking his head yes.
No.
You are such a contrarian. It's unbelievable. You ready? Alan, you ready? Watch. You ready? Day. Frozen again. I don't get it. What is going on here? I am frozen solid. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
We just are talking amongst ourselves, so.
Yeah, we've already solved a couple of problems.
This is crazy. I got to call the IT guy. Oh, wait, that's me. So am I allowed to pick up a pen on Shabbos? The answer is yes. The answer is yes.
Alan got it.
Biblically. Whoa, slow down. Biblically, the only thing that the Torah forbids is for me to write something with the pen.
Okay.
That is one of the 39 categories of forbidden work on Shabbos. I can't write. I can't write a letter. I can't write. But for me, literally, just to pick up a pen off the table is not a biblical violation. It's what in Hebrew we call muktzah. But muktzah, according to most authorities, is only a rabbinic enactment. It's a rabbinic restriction, a fence. Why? Because what does a person do if they have a pen in their hand? They right. might come to write something.
Tempted to write, right.
Exactly. So the idea isn't, oh, you can't do it, you can't do it again. There's a concept of human beings have a nature of forgetting. If I have a pen in my pocket and I want, let me make a quick note of that. I just thought of something I can add to the class and I'll just quickly jot a note. And hello, can't do that. Friday night, everybody went to sleep and I'm sitting there and I'm preparing for next week's class. And I'm like, oh, perfect. Oh, great idea. Start writing it down. If I know that I can't pick up the pen in the first place, I won't come to write anything. So this concept that we are prone to that kind of distractions or forgetfulness is what built into this concept of why you have to build a fence, a physical guardrail, because people are forgetful and the shlemiel and the shlemazel is going to fall. Keep that in mind. What I think if you delve a little bit even further, a little deeper, is that this concept where the Torah is teaching us to be cautious, be mindful of these things, that doesn't appeal to our ego. It really doesn't. It rubs us the wrong way. Because certainly when we're younger, we think we're invincible. We think we defy the laws of nature. It won't happen to me. Oh, please. Mom, stop worrying. How many times have we heard that? Or said that, right? It's risky behavior. Okay, it's not going to happen. We don't like the concept of be cautious, be careful. You know, it could. We don't think along those lines. Why is it that is such a prevalent thrill-seeking society? They take the most crazy risks, you know, behaviors. Why? Okay, they want the adrenaline rush. They like that thrill, right, of living on the edge. Why? Because if you're just cautious, life is boring. That's just, eh. That's vanilla. That's my kind of world. But I think this is part of the problem here. Okay, so I think just on a basic level, this mitzvah of putting up the guardrail of physical protection is to teach us the lesson about the preservation of life as a major moral responsibility, and we have to do whatever we can to remove potential dangers. That's number one. However, I think there's more to this. If we go back to the verse, I'm surprised no one asked this, or maybe you were bothered, but you were just being kind and didn't ask yet. I began the verse as, if you build a new house, remember that? If you build a new house, Why is it? What if I buy a house? It's not new. It's been around since the 50s. Do I have an obligation to put up that fence? The answer is yes. So why does the Torah say if you have a new house, if you build a new house?
It's new to you.
Okay, it's new to you. That's one definitely possibility. But then the Torah can just leave off the word. Just say, if you buy a house, buy or build a house. What's the difference? What's the idea of a new house? So a lot of the commentaries are bothered by this and they give fascinating, beautiful insights. Let's start with a basic. I've seen brought down that this mitzvah of Makkah, which comes towards the end of Devarim, at the end of the book, the fifth book of the Torah, is usually read around Elul, around the month preceding Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Okay? So if it's doing that, if it's, what do you call it? If it's at that point in the year, our minds are already thinking towards a new beginning of a new year, right? It's a new year. You didn't lose me here. Just hold on. Yeah, there's background here for one second.
Yeah, but we still hear you.
Oh, there we go. What? No.
We still hear you, but there is that background noise.
What do you mean? Like a water running or something.
There's got to be a...
Sounds like plumbing.
Yeah.
Mute all. Okay. Okay. Is that better? Can you all hear me, though? Okay, perfect. Obviously, unmute yourself if you have something to say. Okay. So some of the commentary is saying that this new house, meaning it's a new home in the beginning of a new year. We're starting again. It's fresh. It's new. We need to do something. We need to do something to safeguard our rooftop. We need to clear our mind. We go into a new year. Yes, there are definitely feelings of guilt. Somebody once said to me, what does the month of Elul mean? I said, G-U-I-L-T. It's a month of guilt, of where we start doing introspection. And I'm joking. Obviously, that is important. But the idea that we need to safeguard our minds, our thoughts, our headspace, so that we go into the year with a clear understanding of what I want to accomplish this year, that'll protect for the rest of the year. That's how some commentaries learn. But I think it's much deeper. I think it's wonderful. I want to read you an article, a beautiful, beautiful insight on this point from Rabbi Silber here in Baltimore. What a great insight. He writes the following, that the Torah here is teaching us that the home represents a new life initiative. When you embark upon something new, so then you must set boundaries. Just as the fence is the boundary for a roof, we must learn to make boundaries in life. Listen to the next three paragraphs. Short. Life is filled with much new construction. We build new relationships and careers. We start new journeys and explore new possibilities. Whenever we start something new, we must learn to establish appropriate boundaries and erect the necessary fences. Our careers may thrust us into a world that does not share our values and ideals. The demands and expectations of the workforce may put us in situations of spiritual and moral discomfort. What fences must be created to ensure that we don't lose our spiritual identities while climbing the ladder of success? What can we each do to protect our personal holiness, even while spending our days in environments which may not be conducive to personal growth? Marriage, relationships require a great deal of effort and attention. At times, we take liberties with the dignity, honor, or feelings of a beloved spouse. At times, we do things which are hurtful, insensitive, and demeaning. What fences do we need to create in our marriages and relationships to ensure that we are each behaving as a proper spouse, nurturing marital love and growth? And finally, on a personal level, we are often bombarded by temptation and desire. What fences should we create for ourselves to ensure that we continue down the path of growth and not fall into the abyss of personalistic darkness? In life, we are constantly embarking on new construction. We construct homes of careers, relationships, and develop ourselves. Each of these beautiful homes requires a fence. It is the fences of self-discipline, moral clarity, spiritual motivation, and desire for growth, which ensure that which we build will be beautiful, fulfilling, and safe for ourselves and for those whom we love. You couldn't have written this any better. Frozen. This is like... I give up. It's recording, but I don't even know where to say it.
You're back, but you're muted. So you have to unmute. Oh, there
you go. I don't know where I lost you. I give up. Where did I lose you?
We got through all of the quote.
You got through the whole Rabbi Silber piece?
Yes. And then you said you couldn't have written it better.
That you could not have written that any better. It is exactly the point I wanted to make. He summarized it so perfectly. And that is, this mitzvah of putting up a safeguard is not limited to a physical guardrail on your roof or on your porch. This is a life lesson. We are always building. We're always accomplishing. Never forget to put up a fence to protect yourself. We don't live in a perfect world. We don't live in a society that's 100% in line and conducive to our value system. So what fences do we put in place to help us? That's what the Torah is telling us here. But wait, take it one step even further. And I love this. The Medrash tells us the following. This mitzvah of putting up a fence on the roof applied even to the flat roof of the temple building. The temple in Jerusalem, the Heichal. You say, one second. Nobody's walking up on top of the roof of the temple in Jerusalem. Why would the Torah demand that I have to put a fence there also? I saw something so beautiful. This opens up the last piece of what I want to share with you on this. Oh, you know what this represents? The roof. The roof represents height, right? It represents something high. You usually have that as the top of your home, right? Or any place that's considered a high area, you have to put up a fence. When you talk about height, you're talking about arrogance. You're talking about a lack of humility. Mm. High and mighty. Mm-hmm. The roof represents that highness, that haughtiness, that arrogance. Mm. I'll even show you how this plays out. So beautiful. None of you asked me, what does the word ma'akeh even mean? What does it mean? Does it have a translation? So we loosely translated it as a fence. But there is no other occurrence of this word in the entire Torah. No other word that even comes close. Rav Hirsch, as you know, I love to quote when it comes to etymology of words. Rav Hirsch writes that this word ma'aka is related to the word amok, the same root letters. Amok means deep. Like we say in Tehillim, mimamakim kirasicha Hashem, from the depths I call out to you, Hashem. A ma'akeh versus the roof. The roof is the natural inclination that I feel high and mighty. I stand tall, up high, with my sense of pride and arrogance, perhaps. What do you have to do, says the Torah? Build a ma'akeh. Build something where you're going deep down. You need to build something that's going to keep you grounded. Not become arrogant. Remain with a level of humility, depth, deep lowliness. Make ourselves deep with humility, not high and haughty. This is a really important concept that we see throughout the Torah. For simple reason, I'll give you an example. The highest ranking person besides the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, who's really the highest ranking from a spiritual standpoint of the nation, the counterpart to that, the highest level ranked position, is the king, the melech. There is a special mitzvah in the Torah that the king must have a Torah with him wherever he goes. Obviously not the bathroom. But he has to have a small little Torah wherever he goes, at every meeting, he's working out. He's got to have a Torah right there with him at all times. You say, why? It's a nice idea. It would remind us of doing the right thing. But why specifically the king? Is because the king is the most susceptible to feel that he's superior to everybody else. He is the one who is most prone to think he's above the law. Oh, how many times have we seen people in positions of authority abuse that privilege because they think they're above the law? It happens way too often. The Torah demands of the king, who is the highest ranking position, who is the most susceptible and prone to think he's above the law, you carry that Torah with you wherever you go, buddy, because nobody, nobody is that high. The Torah trumps it all. The Torah demands that you follow the law regardless of who you are. You go ahead, 1 second, Liz. You can't. There are other commandments that he's required. He's not allowed to have too many horses. He can't have too many wives. He can't amass too much wealth. Why? Rabbi Sachs writes, because these are all symptoms of a problem. The cause is that he thinks he's above the people. He's above the law. Therefore, the insistence the Torah has on his humility, because that's his essential role of being a role model for the nation. You have to set the standard right, because all eyes are on you, King. You have to know this is not the right thing. You can't forego your honor, but you also can't allow your emotions to have superiority over others. Liz.
Who would be responsible for making the fence on the temple?
When they built it, they would put it up.
Don't you have someone who, like, every Friday before a rental has to come check the...
No. If the fence is there, the fence is there. It's not... There's no requirement. Obviously, if you see that there's disrepair, this, you know, whatever, you have to fix it. Yes. I think that midrash isn't... I don't know if it's meant to be taken literally, that they had to physically build it. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But the question is, what's the significance? Why? And I think this is the idea. And that is, when it comes to this concept that despite our accomplishments, and there's nothing wrong, I'll be very clear, nothing wrong with taking pride in our accomplishments. But when we cross the line from pride and it becomes arrogance of a superiority over others, we have crossed a line, and the Torah says you must figure out a fence of where you build that humility. That's the requirement. And it's true even for spiritual accomplishments. That's why it has to be even on the temple. A person who becomes a great scholar has a lot to be proud of. Great Torah knowledge, it's a wonderful thing. But if all of a sudden you think you're God's gift to it, there's a problem. And therefore, the requirement is you have to put a fence. You have to learn to have that safeguard. Don't let that arrogance override. This is the beauty of why Moshe was considered the greatest leader. Why? Because the Torah says he was the most humble. What do you mean? Humble is meek. It's weak. No, you misunderstand. Humility is where I know I have the talent, but I understand that God gave it to me. And it comes with even greater responsibilities. That's not arrogance. That's true humility. There's a beautiful Talmud that says wherever you find God being described and with his greatness, you immediately find him right in that story, or right after, an example of his modesty, of his humility. And it brings three examples, one after the other, after the other. I'm not going to share it with you. I'm going to share with you a different, more current story. Listen to this story. Rabbi Sachs also, great story. In the context of the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth II, right? Just passed away.